From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. 5 years ago, at 29, Ross Douthat became the youngest ever op-ed columnist at the New York Times. Conservative columnist. Douthat is a thinker, not a bomb thrower, but he's ready to mix things up in the GOP. A calm proponent of reform conservatism. New policy, he says, for a new day. This hour On Point, Ross Douthat on conservative reform. You can join us on air or online. Well, this conversation is always on. Do you see a conservative move to get outside the Reagan-era box, as Douthat puts it? What would that look like? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at OnPoint Radio. Joining me now from Washington is Ross Douthat, columnist for the New York Times, author of Bad Religion, How We Became a Nation of Heretics, and co-author with Rayhan Salam of Grand New Party, How Republicans Can Win the Working Class and Save the American Dream. Ross Douthat, welcome back to On Point.
Thanks so much for having me. It's great to be here again.
It's great to have you. I don't know if you call yourself a reform conservatism advocate.
I actually only call myself a bomb thrower, so I was
yeah.
a little taken aback
yeah,
to
sorry.
Have that title stripped from me.
Reload, Ross. Reload. I don't know if this is your main man, but here's Rand Paul talking with Glenn Beck last week, saying the GOP has to have a major transformation.
I think Republicans will not win again in my lifetime for the presidency unless they become a new GOP, a new Republican Party, and it has to be a transformation.
Okay, our thinking man's bomb thrower then, Ross Douthat. I don't know if you line up with Rand Paul's vision of transformation exactly. I don't know if you call yourself an advocate of conservative reform, but I read you, may I use the word religiously, and it seems to me that you're really pulling for some kind of conservative reform. What do you see? What are you pulling for, Ross?
Well, I mean, I think that, you know, what Senator Paul said is something that pretty much every younger and more ambitious Republican elected official has decided after the 2012 election. I think that what we saw in the 2012 campaign was sort of the last attempt to run on a Republican playbook that the party has used very, very effectively, but with diminishing effectiveness for the last 30 to 35 years. And I think that that defeat and the shock of that defeat, because, of course, many Republicans had persuaded themselves that the economy was so bad and President Obama mm-hmm. so unpopular that, of course, Mitt Romney was going to sweep to victory. The shock of that defeat, I think, has occasioned a lot of rethinking that's taken a lot of different forms. And I think that, you know, you've used the term reform conservatism, and that's the term that I and maybe a few of my journalist and policy wonk friends like to use to describe what we think is the best approach for the Republican Party to take. But it is only one of the options out there. And I think it's useful if you look at the immediate aftermath of the 2012 election. I think the most popular idea, which I think was very popular among the Republican Party's donors, was the idea that the only thing the Republicans needed to change was their position on immigration reform.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And that by, you know, just allowing some kind of comprehensive immigration reform bill to pass and getting that issue off the table, the party would become competitive with Hispanics again and would gain that, you know, 2 to 3 percentage point boost that it needs to be competitive in presidential elections going forward mm-hmm. in what will obviously be a more Hispanic, more multiracial electorate. And so that was, I think, the sort of most powerful idea for at least the first 6 months after the election. And this idea had a convenient corollary, which was that once you passed immigration reform, then you didn't have to change anything else.
All done.
All done. Right. And maybe I think a lot of these donors tended to be more socially liberal. So that was where they were more out of step with the party as a whole and more unhappy with it. But they were perfectly happy with the economic messages that Mitt Romney pitched and, you know, happy with a sort of fairly hawkish foreign policy and so on. I think the vision that I think has gained a little more traction more recently, thanks to a number of Republican senators, I think, including led by Senator Mike Lee of Utah, but sort of picked up by figures ranging from Marco Rubio to John Thune and others, has been what I think the party actually needs. And this is self-serving because these are ideas that I support.
Your ideas, yeah.
But a more comprehensive shift in economic policy that doesn't repudiate social conservatism and doesn't say, you know, okay, all you religious conservatives, you know, we're happy to have your votes, but please don't bother us when it comes time to make policy. Mm-hmm. But instead sort of proceeds from general socially conservative premises about the importance of the two-parent family and family stability in American life, and tries to make that a kind of focus of policy reform. It basically tries to spend more energy than Republicans have spent recently thinking about the broad array of socioeconomic challenges facing the working class, and issues like wage stagnation and family breakdown and the long-term unemployment and the way that set of issues is sort of interacting to make it harder for Americans to be economically and socially mobile. So if you look at some of the ideas that have been floated mostly by Republican senators recently, they've ranged from Senator Lee's tax plan, which would, unlike the plan that Mitt Romney proposed, which was basically just a tax cut for the wealthy, Mike Lee's plan would focus more on cutting taxes for families and creating a new and larger child tax credit. And then alongside that, Senator Thune has talked about embracing some ideas to help the long-term unemployed, creating vouchers that let people who want to move from one state to another in search of work make that kind of move, create incentives for businesses to hire people who have been out of work for a very long time. And then Senator Rubio came out with a sketch of a proposal on the safety net, which would try and reform the earned income tax credit so it reaches more workers. And actually, in that case, doesn't right now. It mostly helps families. But you have this problem where one of the reasons you have family breakdown in America is that there are fewer marriageable men at the bottom of the income ladder. And so Rubio's proposal would try and raise the earned income tax credit potentially for single workers and particularly for single men, thus in theory, creating more economic capital at the bottom of the ladder. And then this has overlapped with ideas on criminal justice reform, trying to reduce the incarceration rate, which, again, is sort of the idea being that you basically don't want to take so many young men out of circulation, not only because it's unjust to them to be imprisoned for long periods for minor offenses, but because of the impact on the community left behind. So anyway, that's sort of a brief, and you know, I could go on, but there are a bunch of ideas floating around that I think all have in common this focus on what used to be just the problems of the underclass and are increasingly problems for the working class and are increasingly problems for voters who vote Republican, working class white voters the Midwest and the border South and so on. So that's the case for a sort of reformist optimism. But it's by no means the only game in town. And it's obviously by no means clear that the party as a whole is ready to get on board with this kind of agenda.
Well, I want to dig in to the policy and the politics of this. I mean, you've got, as you say, this new generation of conservative thinkers, James Capretta and Brett Wilcox, Avik Roy, Kay Heimowitz, Ramesh Panaru, Moore, yourself. But you have been musing, I think, just last month about this sort of if a tree falls in the woods and nobody hears it, is it really there? They say you asked in American life if you have political ideas, but you don't have partisan champions.
Right.
What are you? It's sort of like attempting to cheat at cards or pay for dinner with counterfeit cash. You have just reeled off the names in Mike Lee and Rubio and John Thune and more of some who may be carrying this flag now. I want to look at the policies that they're pushing. Is it clear to you that they are a substantial enough number in the GOP or a saleable enough message that this is the way things go rather than, I don't know, toward where we've been or back into the Reagan box, which you say it's maybe time to move a bit out of?
I think most of this will be sort of shaken out and determined by the 2016 presidential election, because what you have right now in the Republican Congress is a House of Representatives that just isn't going to be a source of reform proposals or really any kind of proposals whatsoever. I mean, you have individual House members who have reform proposals and ideas, and you have one case, the case of Medicare reform, where Paul Ryan basically successfully sort of forged a real consensus in the House around that idea. But since then, there's been no sort of successor, no successor policy. And, you know, what we've seen in the House over the last year is a mix of just intransigence and total and disorganization that makes it impossible for the party to even attempt to govern out of that institution. So, you know, you cannot, I mean, you see this in the debt ceiling debates and so on. John Boehner can't get enough of his members to support basically anything on sort of very basic questions like raising the debt ceiling and negotiating budget deals and so on. So it's very hard to imagine something happening on healthcare reform or tax reform.
But it's the one Republican leg of the stool. I mean, you got the presidency, right, the House, and the Senate. That's the one. They're not moving. Does that make thinkers like you just outliers, Ross? Does it?
It's made us fairly irrelevant, I would say, for much of the last 3 or 4 years. And I think, you know, so you, I think at the end, I probably said this in the column, but I think at the end of the Bush presidency in 2006, 2007, 2008, it was fair to say that conservatism was intellectually exhausted. And what's happened over the past few years is it ceased to be intellectually exhausted. There is intellectual energy, but at least until now, there hasn't been a political conduit for that energy to impact.
Hold the thought right there if you'd be good enough. Columnist for The New York Times, I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Talking this hour with thinker, conservative, Ross Douthat, New York Times columnist, soft-spoken, big platform advocate of reform conservatism. And he says it's out there waiting to happen. One of those active in politics right now who he sees as a potential flag bearer for thinking anew outside the Reagan-era box, as Ross Douthat puts it, Senator Mike Lee of Utah. He gave the Tea Party's response to President Obama's State of the Union address. Here's Mike Lee on that occasion.
As a nation, we are once again at a critical turning point. Now, as in 1773, Americans have had it with our out-of-touch national government. But if all we do is protest, our Boston Tea Party moment will occupy little more than a footnote in our history. Hopefully, our leaders, reformers, and citizens will join the journey from Boston to Philadelphia, from protest to progress. Together, we can march forward and take the road that leads to the kind of government we do want.
Senator Mike Lee of Utah, who Ross Douthat sees as maybe one of those who will carry forward here. If all we do is protest, said Mike Lee, in that response to the president's State of the Union address, may just be a footnote in history. But there's new thinking out there, Ross Douthat says, and maybe some politicians on the right, on the conservative flank, who will drive it forward. Ross, I've got lots of questions for you, but so does our listening audience. Joel in Nashville, Tennessee. Joel, you're on the air with Ross Douthat.
Hi, Tom.
Hi. What do you think,
Joel?
Ross, I really admire the intellectual rigor of your column, and I was wondering if you could speak to maybe how hospitable you feel the Republican Party is to intellectuals in general, or do you feel that both parties are equally hospitable, and you see a general strain of anti-intellectualism in either party?
I think that really going back to the 1950s and early 60s, the Republican Party has always been more sort of self-consciously anti-elitist and therefore sort of critical of America's intellectuals. I think there's a distinction between being critical of intellectuals and being anti-intellectual. But I think that has been true in the past and remains true today. And I think it's sort of a mistake. You'll sometimes hear liberals say, you know, oh, for the good old days when conservatism meant William F. Buckley Jr., you know, who was so intellectual, and now we have Glenn Beck and Sarah Palin and so on. But if you go back to the 50s and 60s, William F. Buckley was writing in support of Joe McCarthy, who was, you know, nobody's idea of the intellectual's favorite senator at that time. So I think there's always been this strong populist strain on the American right, precisely because conservatives have always recognized that the conservative perspective on a lot of issues is just not widely shared within the American intellectual elite. And so you can either sort of spend your life as a conservative sort of, you know, trying to sort of shift the views of intellectuals on the margins, or you can embrace a certain kind of populism. And I think that's what the right has done. The trouble is it can get taken too far. I think populism can be a very healthy force in our society, but I think it could be a destructive force as well. And what happened in, for instance, the government shutdown last fall, I think is a case of what happens when the populist party basically becomes too populist for its own good. It sort of loses sight not only of policy ideas, but really of basic political strategy. So I think what you're seeing right now, hopefully, from politicians like Mike Lee, who was, of course, you know, was elected as a Tea Party candidate, is a populist figure, was involved in the government shutdown, is an attempt to learn from that experience and say, okay, we're still going to be populists. We're still going to be critical of Washington and, you know, the way the Acela corridor does business, if you will. But we're also going to be smarter about it, and we're going to marry that sort of populist critique to more substantive ideas. So that I think is that's the sweet spot for conservatism in America, at least as it's been over the last few generations. A combination of a sort of outsiderish middle American populism with some real policy heft and a real policy critique of the way things get done. And at its best, that's how conservatism has served the country well.
You wrote last fall memorably about what you called good populism and bad populism. You're
right.
Touching on it here, but elaborate on that. You talked about populism broadly for the GOP as something like, you said, Homer Simpson's beloved beer, both the cause of and the solution to all of their problems.
Right.
What's good populism in your terms, and what's bad these days, Ross?
Well, I think what's been interesting about this era in Republican politics is that the same figures and groups have been the source of both some of the party's more destructive decisions, like the government shutdown and the sort of constant debt ceiling brinksmanship, and some genuinely new and fresh policy ideas. And I think that points to, you know, good populism is a populism that, you know, that has a serious critique of power, of concentrated power, of the way America is governed right now, of the sort of cozy incestuousness of Washington, D.C., but doesn't use that critique as a reason to just sort of, you know, throw things against the wall and scream, basically. And bad populism is a populism that takes that critique and says, so therefore, all we need to do is just fight, you know, fight harder. And this is what I think you heard a lot of on the right during the government shutdown. You've heard a lot of it over the last few years, the idea that the problem is Republicans just aren't willing to fight hard enough to defeat President Obama. And that is, you know, maybe sometimes has been the case, but for the most part, Republicans just haven't controlled enough of the government to be able to defeat President Obama. And if you set out to, you know, sort of fight a president when all you control is the House of Representatives, you're going to make a mess of things and probably lose. And that's what we saw play out last fall. But I just think it's important to emphasize, you get this media narrative that says, well, the Republican Party's problem is, you know, is the Tea Party. And if only the sort of moderate establishment types were in charge, everything would be better. But quite often, you know, the moderate establishment types are, you know, idea free and partially corrupt. I mean, that's sort of the nature of a moderate establishment in either party. It's very friendly to business interests, to special interests. It's very accustomed to sort of doing things the way they've, you know, the way they're always done in Washington. It doesn't like to see cozy arrangements upset and so on. And moderate establishments need forces like the Tea Party to come along and upset them. The trick is that then there also needs to be a rebalancing, because otherwise things collapse into chaos.
So when you like all of us, heard House Speaker John Boehner not so long ago very memorably saying, "Are you kidding me? Are you kidding me?" Were you sympathetic to him, or is that the discomfort of the cozy?
It's a little bit of both, right? But I mean, I'm sympathetic to Boehner overall. Boehner has an incredibly difficult job because there is a portion of the House Republican caucus that are simply bad populists, in the language I was just using. Mm-hmm. They basically feel like they came to Washington to do two things, to repeal Obamacare and to cut government. And they aren't interested in doing anything else. And when they don't have the votes to do the things they want, they basically say, well, we're taking our ball and going home. We're not going to, you know, we're not going to give you our vote on any kind of compromise, any kind of even negotiating tactic. And so again and again, Boehner has had to deal with this reality that he technically has a majority, but a chunk of his majority isn't really willing to do any of the work of governing. So that's the sympathy for Boehner, is that he's dealing with bad populism. He's in a position where, you know, if he just sort of tried to throw that part of the party overboard, then he would lose his speakership. And his job has been mostly to prevent, you know, actual disaster, an actual default, you know, an endless government shutdown and so on. And he hasn't, you know, he's done a reasonably good job. But that being said, you don't look to John Boehner for the future of the Republican Party, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that if John Boehner were just suddenly magically put in charge of the GOP in sort of absolute terms, the party would cut a lot more deals and Washington would work more smoothly. Mm-hmm. But there wouldn't be a new Republican Party capable of addressing the emerging challenges of 21st century America. It would just be a sort of cozy deal-making party that made sure bills got signed but didn't really have that much to contribute to the national conversation. And again, this isn't a knock on Boehner. Boehner is who he is. He's
right.
A career politician who's good at making deals.
Yep.
But you need that sort of both grassroots and ultimately intellectual energy in the party to get things done. And it's not a coincidence that it's coming from Mike Lee, Rand Paul, Marco Rubio, figures elected in the Tea Party wave.
Ross Douthat, raising the flag for reform conservatism, looking around for who might carry it. And I guess the question of whether it wins at the polls. Let's go to Arlington, Massachusetts. Jim, on the air with – Jim, you're on with Ross.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Ross.
Hey, Jim.
Great show, as always. Ross, you mentioned this emerging congressional leadership for conservative reform, but I must say I'm skeptical about the existence of a constituency for that program that would be enough to actually form a majority for the Republican Party. You talked about offering moving credits so people could go where jobs are,
mm-hmm.
reform of the earned income tax credit, and so forth. But as I understand it, those ideas are being offered by people who are also wanting to cut back substantially on the existing social safety net programs,
yes.
and maintaining anti-choice, anti-gay equality, and so forth, social programs. And I'm just not sure the numbers add up. That stuff seems like pretty weak tea compared to the stuff it's bundled with.
I guess you
well,
could
I
look
one
at
way,
it.
One way to look at it, right, mm-hmm. is that, you know, the existing Republican message resonates with between 42% and 47% of the country, let's say. And in an off-year election, when voter turnout is lower, it gets up closer to 50%, which is why Republicans are competitive in the House and Senate. So what the Republican Party needs to do is what any political party needs to do. It needs to figure out where is that other 5% coming from. And I think one option is for the party to say, okay, well, we used to have a lot more upper middle class, pretty well off, somewhat socially liberal voters who voted for us in states like Connecticut mm-hmm. and to a lesser extent Massachusetts, but in the Northeast and so on. And that party would say, okay, to get those voters back, we're going to take on some of the issues you mentioned. We're going to evolve on gay marriage. We're going to stop talking about abortion and so on. And we're going to keep our basic economic platform that's, you know, fairly pro-business and tilted towards the wealthy and so on. And I think that that's a model that a lot of Republicans believe in, especially Republicans in places like New York City and Washington, D.C. I think the model that's being suggested here is looking at things slightly differently and saying, actually, the Republican Party has done better over the last 20, 30 years with working class voters, especially white working class voters, than it ever did before. And a lot of these voters are voting Republican in part because they're more socially conservative, because of issues like abortion. Less so, I think, gay marriage, which is an issue where change is happening so rapidly that I don't think it's likely to be a winning issue for Republicans in the immediate future. But abortion has been in certain ways a winning issue in terms of winning formerly Democratic blue-collar voters to the Republican side. And so another possibility would be to say, okay, well, let's build on that and say we're going to have a party that's sort of moderately socially conservative, that's pro-life and pro-family in a general sense, and we're going to look for policies that are less tilted towards the wealthy and the interests of the rich and more tilted towards working and middle-class families. And that's, I think, what this reform model would do. It would say, look, we're going to try and make the Republican Party more competitive in a state like Pennsylvania, for instance, rather than trying to, you know, win back the lost Rockefeller Republicans of Connecticut. And I think your initial question, how does this work if Republicans are also voting to massively slash the safety net at every opportunity? And the answer is, in part, it doesn't, right? That if the Republican Party's goal is to take the share of government down to 15% of GDP or something.
From 18, 19, is it now?
It's 18 or 19 now, right? And I think if your goal is to start, is to really, really slash and get to like 15% or beyond that, you know, the sort of dream of repealing the New Deal and getting back to the federal government as 10% of GDP and so on, that's both unrealistic as policy, I think, but it's also, I think, political poison. And so it doesn't – if that's where the party sits in a couple of years' time with budget blueprints that are just, you know, eliminating – every social program and so on, then you're not going to have a new Republican majority and you don't really have new Republican policy thinking. But I think what you're seeing in Rubio's proposal, which is not ultimately a proposal to cut the welfare state, it's a proposal to change the way it spends money in various ways, but the goal is to be revenue neutral. Or similarly with Lee's tax proposal, where again, the goal is revenue neutrality, not to starve the beast and so on. I think you're seeing the beginnings of a Republican Party that says, okay, we're not planning to gut government. We're not planning to eliminate all its functions. Our goal is going to be a limited government party that tries to keep the government roughly the size it is now, that tries to avoid a massive expansion of government like what we're potentially on track with if entitlements aren't reformed, but then is also interested in how government programs work and in removing perverse incentives, making government programs work to increase upward mobility and so on. So that's I think, the economic sweet spot where you're saying, you know, we're socially conservative, not in a Todd Akin style, but in a, you know, in a pro-family, in a pro-family style. And we've got the economic policies that go well with that social message.
Ross,
but again, this is and the caller is right to say that this is mostly still hypothetical.
I thought, Jim, our caller was going in a different direction on electoral viability maybe. I mean, I wonder, you talk about that white working class voter who's you need to swing your way, and as the kind of thinking wing of the party, I wonder if the GOP is so stoked, I don't know, race fear, anger among that class so much that it's not listening to someone like you now because it's just been groomed in another direction. Or if that one time middle class is so gutted that it's skeptical even of your policies when it comes to any policy.
Well, that's – I think the second point is really important. I think in certain ways one of the reasons Republicans need this kind of agenda is because – if the middle class keeps being gutted, there isn't a Republican future, period. Because right now the Republican Party is, you know, it has a lot of wealthy voters, but the core of Republican support is white, married, hardworking, middle class families in flyover states, basically. And to the extent that that demographic is getting hammered by economic trends, you're just not going to have a Republican coalition in the future. So you have to do more in economic terms to help that demographic just to keep the core. Yeah, the core of the party needs, in effect, more help. But we'll take up the first point when we come back.
Yeah, Ross Douthat, please stand by. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with New York Times columnist, conservative columnist, Ross Douthat, joining us today from Washington. He's been writing about, among other things, reform conservatism. He would like to see it take off. There are some ideas out there being now touted by Mike Lee, Marco Rubio, maybe John Thune, and more. He'd like to see it gain more prominence, but you can hear he's not exactly sure they will. Ross, lots of response online here. It's funny. Miriam writes to us, says, Douthat's prescriptions remind me of the white-collar, aspirational Catholicism of my grandparents. Work diligently, drink in moderation, go to Mass, and keep your pants on until you're married. Miriam writes, that path closed in the 1960s. I don't know, maybe. Karen in Lake Martin, Alabama. Karen, thank you for calling. You're on the air with Ross Douthat.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Ross.
Hi, Karen.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Actually, I love what you just said, because there's a whole group of women that I think that the party has really not just ignored, they've lost. I've been a Republican since my college days in the 60s, and I'm just angered. And as are many of my professional women friends, we're just angered over the social policy, particularly abortion, that we fought for, the right for a woman to have an abortion. And they have made this so prominent in the within the party ranks that we just dropped out. And we're silent about it. You don't know we've dropped out, but let me be the first to tell you we've dropped out.
So what would it take, Karen? A 180 on abortion? Would the Republican Party have to embrace it?
Absolutely. Yes. Let me give you the line of thinking. The Republican Party has defined life as beginning at conception.
Mm-hmm.
And all life is sacred. There are several things, and I won't even get into one aspect of it. I'm just going to stick to the abortion aspect of it. All life is sacred. But here's the thing. Where is the Republican Party marching on fertility clinics and cryo labs across the country with all of these potential little human beings sitting in a vial? They have been conceived, and they would come to life
mm-hmm.
if they were not thrown in the garbage regularly. So from a woman's perspective, it only matters when the embryo is implanted in a woman, not when it's sitting in a test tube.
But it's choice. Our argument
is a false one.
It's choice that would bring you back, Ross.
I think Karen's point about fertility clinics is completely well taken. I think the issue there, though, is not necessarily a lack of consistency on the part of abortion opponents. It's more that fertility clinics are just much more popular with the country as a whole than is abortion. So if the Republican Party started marching on fertility clinics, it would reap a immense backlash from a lot of people who right now consider themselves pro-life.
What's your metric on that assertion about relative popularity? I mean, how do you come up with that, Ross?
I'm basing it on the fact, I think political parties respond to public opinion as much as they shape it. And if there were a large constituency for regulating fertility clinics, there would be politicians who are in favor of regulating fertility clinics. But also, I think if you look at the way the fertility industry has developed, it's developed on, I mean, we're getting a bit afield here, but it's developed on essentially what seems like the ultimate pro-life pitch, right? It's saying,
yeah,
you know,
let's make life. But Karen's point seems to be, look, you've shut down access to abortion across the country, the GOP, and that's really got rubbed her the wrong way. But, you know,
but
here's the business
of
fertility
clinics.
Think
about how the debate over, just to push
mm-hmm.
on this for a second, think mm-hmm. about how the debate over embryonic stem cell research played out, right? Because there was a case where Republicans were actually, you know, trying to protect actual embryos on ice from being dissected in scientific experiments. And the kind of media backlash, forget the public opinion backlash, the kind of media backlash against Republicans saying they were anti-science and that they wanted sick people to die because they wouldn't get cures from you know, embryonic stem cells and so on was immense. So I think that that's a good indicator of what would happen if Republicans called for greater regulations on the fertility industry in general. But I would say personally that, you know, as someone who's pro-life, I think the fact that you have frankly, an unknown number, because the industry is completely unregulated, of tiny human beings sitting in freezers around the country that may eventually be thrown out is, in fact, very morally problematic.
But that just to step business back to the electoral, doesn't have...
The electoral
go to Karen's bigger point, the war. She's kind of taking the war on women theme up here as someone who you can hear would very likely be in the Republican camp. It's kind of in her voice if it weren't for that. How do you win her?
Well, I don't know that... It depends where abortion ranks on her list of voting priorities. And I think that there is a Republican message that would focus on areas where there is a little more common ground on abortion, looking at second and third trimester abortions and so on. And obviously, there's a big difference between having that conversation and having the ridiculous and offensive conversation that Todd Akin wanted to have about, you know, about whether pregnancy can actually result from rape and so on. So I think there is, in theory, more common ground where a pro-life party can appeal to people who are sort of lukewarmly pro-choice on those issues, right? Because we're not going to ban all abortions in America tomorrow. And I think that people who are sort of uncertain on the issue and open to some restrictions but not others could be met in the middle by a still pro-life GOP.
Let's just ask Karen, let's ask her, Karen, what would it take for you on this issue of abortion? We can't cover everything here, but to bring you back to the GOP, Karen.
I think I'm at a stage right now, as are many of my professional friends. I'm a professor.
Mm-hmm.
So normally I would be, you know, sort of, you would expect me to be liberal, but I am actually, I call myself a recovering Republican because I've been a Republican since college days in the 60s and all. But I'm so angered and I'm offended that the party believes that I'm not smart enough to make decisions on my own sexual health or pass those messages along to my daughter and granddaughters because I am. I do pass those messages along. We are capable of making decisions with our doctors about our health and what's beneficial to us as a group. And to have the party determine and want to regulate sexual behavior, that's not a place for that. Concentrate on the economy. Concentrate on jobs. Concentrate on things that are important.
Ross, I'm not sure you can ever get Karen back. If that's her line in the sand, it's not a matter of trimester.
Well, right. If there's no room for abortion regulation in someone's worldview, then they aren't going to probably be a Republican voter in the immediate future. But the reality is that, you know, America is a country deeply divided on the abortion issue. And it's a country where the number of people calling themselves pro-life has actually inched up slightly since the 1990s. And it's a country where men and women overall are pretty much evenly divided on the issue as well. You don't have a huge difference between women identifying as pro-life or pro-choice and men. The genders are as split as the country. So it's not a clear case where, you know, there's this huge group of female voters who are turning on the Republicans only because of this issue and so on. And in fact, there are lots of voters, and again, female voters, who are more likely to vote Republican because the party is pro-life. And I think the point Karen raises about focusing on important issues like the economy and so on, I think based on this conversation, abortion is a very important issue for Karen, right? And it's very important. She's coming from it at it from a pro-choice premise. But she would be very upset if the Democratic Party tomorrow said, we're going to make some huge compromise with Republicans, where we ban second and third trimester abortions because we want to get something done on the economy. I think Karen would say, what are you doing, right?
She doesn't want government in the middle of that and point
taken. But the reason these issues don't go away is the same reason that past cultural controversies don't go away. The sort of culture war debates, people always talk about them like they're this big distraction from the real work of the economy. But when we think back on American history, it's the culture war debates that we remember because they're about crucial questions like, is unborn human life, does it have legal rights or not? That seems to me like a very important question. I think to Karen, it's a very important question. And when we think back on this era in American history, just as when we think back on the 1870s, nobody really remembers the economic debates of the 1870s. They remember debates over race and immigration and human dignity. And I think it's a mistake to sort of try and say we're going to push those issues off stage and only focus on the economy. I mean, obviously, we've been having this whole conversation about economic policy, and I think economic policy is hugely important. But the social issues stay with us for a reason.
Yeah, I mean, fair enough. Though, the economy, even with all its ups and downs, there was a long-term uptrend. People not so sure about that. They may remember our early 21st century debates on the economy. Karen, I...
All for having them. Yep. I'm just saying there are other debates as well.
Karen, I appreciate your call very much. Let me get one more right here from Orlando, Florida. Kevin, you're on the air with Ross Douthat.
Hi, Tom. So as a populist, it's okay. I can be a populist. Republicans will accept me as long as I don't upset the status quo. Don't give anybody in D.C., any of those political elites, any advice on how to spend money, budget, nothing. Vote and shut up. That's the message the new guest is saying.
You're saying
no,
you're not getting
not
enough perspective as a Tea Party guy?
I'm saying that you have to, that the message that you send to those elites has to have a both a reasonable political strategy and an actual policy agenda behind it. And in some cases, the Tea Party has had that agenda, and in some cases, it hasn't. And when it hasn't had an agenda or a strategy, the result has been defeat, which is what we saw, which is what we saw last fall. So, no, I am completely four square in favor of populism, and I will defend populism in all kinds of context. But I'm not going to defend a populism that just says all we need to do is stand up for our principles and then we'll win, because, you know, that isn't how politics actually works. You stand up for your principles and you also need a strategy. And sometimes the populist wing of the party hasn't had a strategy.
Ross, talk about inequality. It's become the big hot button of the year. It's been growing for a long time. As a thinking conservative, how do you think about that?
Well, I think you think about it in two ways, right? One is the question of what is it that we actually want in American society? Is our goal greater equality of income, period, or is our goal mobility? And those are two related things, but they're also different things, and they have different policy implications.
I think mobility is we've got more people who will sign on for. I mean, people hope that it ends up with greater equality as in a demonstration of opportunity.
Right. I think equality as a demonstration of opportunity is very important. But I think most Americans are not that concerned about the exact, you know, income level of very wealthy people in Vail, Colorado.
But turn us into
wherever.
Something that looks like a perpetual aristocracy, gut the middle, then you've got people who
right.
Are
if there's
be...
people want a middle class, and they want to believe that their children's lives are going to be better than their own, and that is what I think people are worried about. That is what's at risk, and that's also what's related to issues. And this is where the sort of general question of social conservatism comes in: issues that are deeper than just the pre or post tax distribution of income. Because if you look at what leads to mobility, to success, to happiness, it's related to questions of belonging and joining. You know, what does your family structure look like? What does your social group look like? What does your neighborhood look like? What does your community look like? And I think there's more that government can do in those areas to, you know, to build social capital than some conservatives have thought. But I also think that, you know, ultimately there are limits to what government can do in those areas, and there are things that communities have to effectively do themselves.
Do you think market forces are going to bring back greater opportunity in this age, in the global economy we have now, greater opportunity, and with that, a more balanced level of equality in this country's economy?
I think that there are ways in which more unleashing market forces would be helpful to opportunity. I think one of the things that the Tea Party has been absolutely right about is the extent to which a lot of Washington runs on crony capitalism. And so if you actually increase competition in a lot of areas, both with favored industries and in whole terrains like healthcare and education, where you have a lot of basically cartels at work, you would end up getting greater opportunity. And this is something that, you know, Rand Paul and others sort of talk about a lot, that there is a kind of populism that's libertarian that would actually, you know, where deregulation and more competition would be good for the middle class. But I also think there are ways in which market forces, particularly on the global level, are cutting against American workers. And that's where I think there's a role for government policy in building a more solid foundation linked to work and family of financial capital in the lower middle class.
One of our listeners, Coast, asks, is reform republicanism or reform conservatism any more or other than the fresh avatar of Rockefeller republicanism, Russ?
Yes, it's actually very different from Rockefeller republicanism.
Oh.
Because Rockefeller republicanism was both much more socially liberal, for one thing. It was more of that sort of northeastern business class view of the world that I was describing earlier. And Rockefeller republicanism was more, I think, economically liberal, frankly, than reform conservatism would be. It was more interested in sort of just imitating New Deal programs and making sure they worked as well as possible, whereas I think ideally reform conservatism would be about offering an alternative. I think the other force that you could compare it to is Bush-era compassionate conservatism, which was a sort of attempt at conservative reform 10 years ago. And there, the difference I would stress is just that I think compassion is not the right frame for the conservative party to take on these issues. Compassion implies a sort of pity, a sense that, you know, the poor are helpless and need our help. And I think that's more the mission for liberalism. The mission for conservatism is to be about respect, not compassion. To say, look, we're willing to give you a helping hand if you're also willing to help yourself. And that's where I think ideally a lot of these policy ideas would go.
If 2016 is the tell on where the GOP goes, who would you like to see out front?
Oh, goodness. No, I that's the thing. We're out of time, so we can't even get into this. But I think there isn't a clear reform conservative candidate. I think what you want to see is for these kind of ideas to almost be taken for granted. You want multiple candidates to say, here are my three reform ideas, and not just have a single standard bearer. So you want it to sort of be the structure that's already in place, so the candidates don't even have to think too hard about it.
Because
it's hard to think hard when you're running for president.
Are you on that path? Does your reform conservatism have that kind of standing? It's already 2014.
I'll put it this way. It's closer than it was 6 months ago.
Ross Douthat, conservative, columnist for the New York Times. Great to have you. Author of Bad Religion and Grand New Party. Great to have you back with us today, Ross. Thanks so much for your time and insights.
Thank you so much, Tom. It was fun.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. Thanks for joining us. This is On Point.